Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathcast is with Dr. Rory McGill. I've known Dr. Rory for a number of years, and he was or is a GP practitioner that found holistic medicine. And he's got a wonderful story. And I think we ended up talking for a good hour and a half and didn't even start to scratch the surface of all the things that he's involved in. I hope you get some value from this. In fact, I know you will. And at the very end of this podcast, I ask Dr. McGill, what action can people take right away to start to improve their lives based on some of the things that you'll hear today? So again, stick through to the end because I think you'll get some real value from this. We talk about breath work. We talk about emotions. We talk about what is holistic health. We talk about the journey a doctor goes on and maybe some of the frustrations that they get. And we talk about some of the differences between the UK and some other countries when it comes to mental health and general wellness. So a broad range of wellness topics covered today. So enjoy. Just a couple of bits before we get stuck into the breath cast. If you haven't done so already, please like, subscribe and share. It helps grow the community and spread our message. We've got over 100 different instructional breathwork videos now on the channel. So if you're here just for the podcasts and you want to learn more about breathing, maybe you want to feel the breathing. So please, you know, get stuck into the back catalogue and enjoy some of that wonderful free breathwork that's on there. And then the last message from me is, please, if you can and you haven't done so, can you pop on over to Instagram, the link's in the description below, and give us a bit of a follow on there because we're trying to grow that community as well. Anyway, enough yakking from me. Let's get stuck into the breathcast. Here is Dr. Rory McGill. Cheers. We are recording now. So right. Mr. Rory McGill, how are you doing today, sir?
Yeah, well, technically, not that I really care that much, Dr. Rory McGill, but...
I was going to call you that, and I thought, I don't know if you wanted me to use the doctor or not, so sorry, Dr. Rory McGill.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I still remember all those years ago when it happened, and you become that person. It seems really weird that people are calling you a doctor when you've always been Mr. And you think, well, I'm still the same old person. And of course, I'm still the same old person. And because I'm still registered... the GMC, you know, people still call me that. And I use it partly because, weirdly, it makes people feel a lot better about coming to see me, you know, the fact that I'm still Dr. Somebody, even though I would behave exactly the same and know exactly the same stuff if I dropped it. Interestingly, also, you probably know this, but you might not, and some of your audience may not, medical doctors were not really doctors. Most of us in this country, in the UK, it's an honorary title. To be a real doctor, you either got a PhD or a Doctor of Divinity or something like that. That's what's known as a doctorate. Whereas in this country, medical doctors mostly have bachelor degrees, an MB, Bachelor of Medicine, Bachelor of Surgery, but we are called doctors. And of course, what tends to happen is someone says to a PhD person, oh, you're not a proper doctor then. But they are the only proper doctors.
I did not know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So, I don't really mind what people call me.
Well, I will refer to you as Dr. Rory McGill. And I think that's probably a great place to get stuck into the conversation. So can you just share for us kind of what your journey's been and where you got you to today, really?
Yeah, well, I will make it quick because as being 61 years old, it could be a long story. I was born in West Wales and my dad was a doctor. He was a consultant psychiatrist. And we lived for the first 2 years of my life in a Victorian psychiatric hospital, beautiful old building in Carmarthen, West Wales. I don't remember it, the first 2 years of my life living there, but it must have been formative years, you know. And when I was two, the family was getting a bit big, so we moved out to the countryside. But still, that hospital was a big part of my childhood, going there to get a lift home and stuff. And later on, when I qualified, I did go and work there for a while. So I had that background. And as I was growing up, one of six kids, I looked around and I looked at the others and I thought, well, none of these are going to be a doctor, so better be me, you know. And my dad knew quite a few other doctors in the town. I liked them. I thought they were nice people and they were role models. And I thought, I'd quite like to be like them. So went to med school, played a lot of rugby, drank a lot of beer, was a pretty terrible student, to be fair. Managed to scrape through in the end. But the day I started work, my first job, I just loved it and turned from terrible monster student to workaholic, really, who just has always loved every job that I've done. So I did a couple of years in hospital, as everybody does. I joined the Navy, had a few years doing exciting things. Mostly with Royal Marines, and then became a GP in Plymouth for 20 years. And this will be perhaps the more interesting part for your audience, is how I went from being a GP, standard, straight down the line, you come in with a problem, I'll give you a prescription for it, to being what I am now, which is an independent practitioner in holistic medicine and psychotherapy. So just that started for me with hypnosis. I saw a good article in a good old proper medical journal, The Lancet, about the use of hypnosis in irritable bowel syndrome. And I just thought, well, that'll be another useful tool in my toolbox, so I'll go and learn some hypnosis, then I can do it for people with irritable bowel syndrome. It was just a very similar model. Here's a problem, here's a tool to fix it, just like the medical model is. But having done some hypnosis and seen some patients, I realized I needed to know a bit more about how the mind worked. So I thought I'd better do some therapy training. So I did various psychotherapy trainings over a number of years. And in the same mindset, I was always a pragmatist. I was always looking for answers. So somebody would come in with a shoulder or back problem, and I think, okay, I don't just want to give them a pill. So I learned how to do spinal manipulations and how to do acupuncture. Really, what we call Western medical acupuncture, which to start off with, which is if you've got a pain in your shoulder, I'll prod around until I find the painful spot and stick a needle in it. You know, it's as refined as that. But you might struggle to believe this, but some people would come in sometimes who just woken up with a sore neck that morning. You feel around, stick a needle in it. They'd go out the door feeling better. And I thought, this is good. So that was going on. I was learning all these new skills. I was also, as it happened, I was looking at the medications I was prescribing. And I was thinking, wow, I'm glad I'm not taking that one. And, I wouldn't take that one. And it became more that, actually, I wouldn't take that. And I was not taking any medication. And I wouldn't want to give that to my family. And gradually dawned on me that it was I was no longer really fit to do this job because I didn't really believe in it. And I wanted to have more time because I knew long before that every patient who came with me, if I had the time and the people and the skills, most of them would benefit from something other than taking a pill. I still believe there are some people you've got to a certain stage, or you've just been hit by a bus or whatever. You need the medical system. Definitely has its place. I've used conventional medicine in the last few years. 3 years ago, I had a bit of a problem. I had to use some conventional medicine, and I would so again. But I'm very happy to say that I'm prescribed any prescription medication for probably 5 or 6 years. And I no longer insure myself to do so, although I'm still registered by the GMC, so I could. But I don't insure myself, so I don't prescribe anything anymore. And I'm really happy about that. So, sorry, it was a bit long, but that's how I got to where I am now.
That's really interesting. And obviously we've spoke before about this, but it's great to hear about the start as well. I didn't realise that you grew up, and so it was like a mental institution, was it?
It was just on a hill just outside the town, so you could see it from the town.
Yeah.
But it was a big, sprawling kind of Victorian, pre-Victorian. It was built probably a couple of hundred years ago. It had its own grounds, it had its own farm.
Yeah.
And in those days, the mental hospitals were like that. And they, if you use the word asylum, it was a bit like an asylum, which I see as a good thing, because if you're tormented by your mind, being in a place where you could go out to a grassy place with loads of trees and nature, compared to most modern psychiatric wards, which are part of a general hospital, and they're very bleak and hospital-like. I think although we gained something, we definitely lost something too when we closed down all those places.
I forget what the word is they use in Poland. It's like you might know, but it's like asylum, but it's a different word. So in Poland, for example, the doctor can prescribe that you go to the asylum.
And
you'll go there for like a couple of weeks to get well. Yeah. So if you're feeling particularly stressed, they'll say, right, you need to go off. I can't remember what the word's called now.
I don't know the word either, but I think Germany, Switzerland have the same models.
Which I think is wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, in this country, I've recently, in the last 12 months, maybe more, joined an organisation called the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine, which is mostly made up of conventional medics. So I think there's a growing realisation amongst GPs in particular that people fundamentally need lifestyle change in diet and movement and sleep and relationship and stress management. And, they're not giving up their medical model, but they realize that there's much more needed. And if, as a GP, even though most of them are not going to want to leave like me, majority of them do strongly feel that if they had access to somewhere they could get people to go and be taught how to do this stuff, they would do it.
Sanitarium, that's what it's called. That just was really interesting, because you have an image just conjured up for me of what that might look like, but the reality is you go there to get well, and you get to come out of your lifestyle and maybe do some meditation classes and have some salt baths and all these things. And I was like, oh, we could really do with that over here.
Well, it was a great bit of research that you may have heard about. I can't remember how many years ago it was done, possibly in the 60s, and hopefully I'll tell it accurately. It took a bunch of older people, possibly even older than me, and they took them to a disused airfield. Obviously they volunteered, they didn't kidnap them, and they had set this place up. They were all the same age. They'd set the place up that everything in it was representative of the time when these people were about 20 years old. So the pictures on the walls and the furniture style and the films they watched and the music that they listened to and the clothes that they wore, everything was accurately reproducing their 20s. And they spent 2 weeks there, and they measured a whole load of physiological parameters before they started, and they measured them again at the finish, just a couple of weeks. And you know what I'm going to say, you know, they'd literally become younger. And that's interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. Because even when you were saying that, I was thinking, I could already picture myself, if I put myself back in that environment now, somebody that's getting, you know, to the 40s, I think I could already tell that would have some sort of change on me. I already got a little bit excited as you were describing that. So, no, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And I've noticed very occasionally, I've been to school reunions two or three times. I've been to a student reunion a couple of times. And People obviously people probably drink some beer, so that contributes to
Yeah.
it. But people do sort of become a little bit less serious and a bit more frivolous and a bit more as if they were young again.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've all probably experienced that at some point in our life,
Yeah. Yeah.
if
Take
we're
off
open
that
enough.
shackles of age, all those things that oh, we need to be a responsible adult. Let's kind of take some of that off and have some fun.
Yeah, I can't remember who said it. I can never remember my quotes, but some famous person said, "You don't stop having fun because you get older. You get older because you stop having fun."
Oh, that's
Yeah.
powerful. Yeah. That's powerful. I like to have some fun. Can you describe for me when you say you've gone into holistic medicine, what can you give me some ideas of some of the modalities and things that you're using, and what are the most kind of powerful
Yeah.
things that come to mind?
Within holistic medicine, generally, you have the lifestyle things that I talked about. So there's diet, there's that, and supplements, and so nutrition generally, and then environment, as we talked about, just the environmental stuff, like these people had the airfield. But anything that's in your environment, the air, the water, the scenery, nature, the people, your job, stress management, breath work, of course, which is your thing, mind practices, meditation, other practices, the hormetic practices like heat and cold, movement. And not just exercise, but movement generally, psychotherapy, detox. So there are probably others, but that's like a little. And within the holistic medicine community, there'll also be some, you might call it more fringe stuff, and I'm not at all meaning to disrespect it in that way. And I've certainly partaken on both sides of a lot of it, which is healing. And slightly more esoteric kind of stuff. Within that world, people will tend to, practitioners will tend to specialize a little bit. So I tend to be more, just because I'm interested, I do a lot of mind stuff. So as I say, I'm a psychotherapist, but I also sort of look at nutrition, particularly as it applies to the mind. I'll look at breath work and be particularly interested in how it affects your mind. So I'll look at all those things, but always with an idea of how this is affecting your mind. Whereas the practitioner who works upstairs for me in the clinic, he's an osteopath and a naturopath, and he works in as well in what you would call these days functional medicine. So even though he's not a doctor, in some ways he's more medical model than I am. He does quite a lot of blood tests and supplements according to the results of the blood tests. I don't often test that much. But often somebody will come to me and I will think, ah, you're probably more suited to be upstairs. Or somebody may come to him and he'll think, oh, yeah, you're one of Rory's, you need to go there. And often we'll share people like that. Because as a GP, when I started out in the field, when I left general practice, I want to do everything. But and it took me years to give that up. But wanting to do everything is just a recipe for not being very good at anything. So it's
Right.
very tempting to want to do everything because it's all interesting,
Yeah.
and I still keep up with it for my own kind of personal health reasons. But as a practitioner, you have to end up somewhere.
And for you, is that somewhere more to do with the mind? Would that be
Yeah,
the,
very
yeah,
much.
yeah,
Yeah,
okay,
very much so. And maybe it's that's from living in a psychiatric hospital for 2 years. Maybe and having a dad who's a psychiatrist. So, or maybe it's just having this personality that I've got.
But interested to get your thoughts on. So over the last 2 decades, we've gone mental for devices in particular, haven't we? Probably even just the last 10, 12 years. So have you, what shift have you seen with people's mindset since we've gone technologically crazy, I would like to say.
Well, good and bad, of course, because a tool is just a tool, and there's so far There's generally a human being in charge of it. Obviously, we're all interested over the next 50 years whether the tools are going to take us over. But for the time being, so, you know, a hammer is just a tool sat there doing nothing. And, you know, I could go and mend my wall with it. Knock some nails into it, or I could murder someone with it. So a tool is just a tool. What do you do with it? Depends on that. So we have tools. Computer is the big tool, the computer, the mobile phone. So this is where you see the fantastic side of it, in that I can connect with you up there, and it wouldn't matter if you were in Alaska. We could do this exactly the same. We also have access to pretty much any knowledge that you want in your room. Knowledge is now democratic. So as a doctor, for instance, when I started out, people come to me and I'm the expert. I have the knowledge. I've been to university. I've read the books. I have the knowledge. They don't. In my practice now, particularly if a person has an illness that's slightly unusual, but not just then, I want and expect my patient to know at least as much about their illness as I do, because it's their illness. They've only got that one to think about. I've got loads to think about, you know. So it is possible now for a patient to be an expert. And when that started out, maybe I felt slightly threatened, and many doctors do feel threatened by that. But now I completely embrace it. And as I say, I want and expect it. And part of our first appointment will be laying that down, that actually you need to sort of educate yourself about this. Yes, I've got a bunch of tools at my disposal, and I've got a load of knowledge and expertise that I built up over the years, but fundamentally this is your body, this is your mind. You've got to do something with it, and we work together on that. So, but also, as we know, the content of the computer can, you know, there's a whole dark web on there that we could go down. And so there's a whole load of dodgy content on there. But also being surrounded by electronics all day potentially can be harmful to people. Don't know why some people perhaps are more affected than others, but some people will be very affected by electromagnetic frequency. And whether you are very affected or not, some of the practice, like nature bathing or swimming in the sea, grounding with bare feet on the earth, will be helpful anyway to sort of detox from that and ensure that you don't get that way. Then there's technology for recording your body. So my watch can't, because I don't wear a watch, but you know, plenty of watches available now which will tell you not just your heart rate, but your heart rate variability, and you know, how far you're walking, what your fitness rate is going like. It's getting more and more stuff, that wearable technology that will record stuff. Again, there's pros and cons of that. I've had some patients with a kind of health anxiety, and because some of the devices, inevitably, they sort of lose contact temporarily, especially if you're active, and they will tell you sometimes your heart rate went up to 180, and then you'll panic. But it didn't really go up to 180, you know, because if my heart rate went up to 180 while I was sat here now, I would absolutely notice it. There's no way that could happen to me now. And later on, my thing says, oh, when it's 180 while you were doing that conversation, I would think, no, it didn't. I know for a fact it didn't. Now, if I really went on a burst of training now and ran as fast as I could get it to 180, and that would feel fine. And then if my watch said I was doing that, I'd be cool with that. But so I think that there's the accuracy of it, and there's what you do with that data when you get it. So there's that side of it. What do I find particularly useful? Biofeedback. So not just recording something like heart rate variability, but being able to improve it by having a device like an M-Wave or there are various others, which will sort of give me real-time feedback of what my heart rate variability was doing. And then as I do my coherent breathing, I can bring my heart rate variability up in the session. But if I do that on a regular basis, I notice that my overall heart rate variability is coming up, my stress levels are going down. So biofeedback, love that. And you'll know probably that I do, you will, because you witnessed it just for a few seconds, EEG, neurofeedback, which is, can be really, really useful in ADHD, in anxiety, in certain personality disorders, any persistent kind of dysfunction of the brain. I'm slightly sad to say that I'm probably sidelining it because of what I said just now about becoming an expert. If you're going to be properly good at doing neurofeedback, it probably needs to be the one thing that you do. Right. It's never going to be the one thing that I do. I'm, especially at 61, I'm never going to become good enough at it to really, really be as useful as I would like to be. So I'll still use it in the way that I know how to use it. But when I started out, I did have an idea that, yeah, I'll do this and maybe become a neurofeedback practitioner fully. But it's not what I'm going to do. I'm not geeky enough. I think if you're going to do neurofeedback well, in addition to being a good kind of practitioner, a good therapist, you need to be really good with tech. I'm not good with tech, and I'm not sure I've had the motivation to be so. Born at the wrong time, I think.
Well, I enjoyed watching you do it when a couple of years ago when you did the live performance, and you had it on Sunday, and we could see the brainwaves. I found that fascinating. Yeah.
And it is fascinating, and undoubtedly it can work. And of course, you can get the neurofeedback that I use in the clinic is sort of tailored. So depending on what your problem is, I will tailor which bit of the brain I'm training up or down to get a desired effect. But there are devices available, such as the Muse, M-U-S-E, which are sort of off-the-shelf neurofeedback. So you just put the band on, Bluetooth it to your phone, and it's purely designed to get you to an alpha state, which is calm and alert and good for everybody. So it only will do that. That's the only thing it will get you to. But the devices are getting better and better, so I'm sure they'll become more flexible. There's another one out recently. I can't remember its name. But I like those, and I do use the Muse quite often, as I use the M-Wave for heart rate variability quite often for myself, because why wouldn't you? You know, it's not, there is no downside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had a little play with Muse actually, but it was too short. I need to have a real crack at it and really try and work hard. But first experience was interesting to hear the I think you can hear like the rain in the background and stuff.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah. So you can, so it's just meditation augmented. So if I meditate, of course, my mind will wander and I'll bring it back and wander and bring it back, because that's what meditation is about. People think if they've never done meditation, it's a sort of bliss state. But actually, it's a working state. As you bring your attention back to your breath or whatever it may be, that's the point of meditation. With the Muse, all that happens is you sort of get to know that quicker, because the sort of noise of the rain sort of gets louder and you think, okay, it just tells you, get advance warning that actually I've gone off. I need to bring it down. And when you're right down, you get the sound of birds singing. And then you think, oh, I'm in the zone now. As soon as you think that obviously it goes.
Yeah. I was really terrible at it. And it's for me personally, it's only very, very, very recently that I've started to have some reflection alone time, because for years I've always shied away from being alone, and it's like I need to stay busy. And it was only recently I read a book, The 5 a.m. Club by Robin Sharma. I don't know if you've come across this author.
I know Robin Sharma, certainly.
And I read his other book then, The Monk That Sold the Ferrari. So those two books have been really powerful over the last couple of months. But that just encouraged me just to have some time early in the morning, just to journal and have some thinking. And I'm at the very early stages of this, but I was like, oh, there is some power in being alone and not being busy all the time. And I want to go deeper into that. But again, I'm on stage one of that process.
I think one of the secrets of happiness, or what, be more precise, the Greeks called it eudaimonia. And what they are talking about is just being generally okay, because you're not going to be happy all the time. Mm. You know, your mum's just died. Mm. Don't be happy, you know. But you can be very sad, but at the same time, you can be okay. Because it's okay to be very sad when your mum's died. So the eudaimonia idea is that whatever happens, you just won the lottery, you're really happy. Mm. You're okay, because you understand that it's just a one thing. It's not life. Winning the lottery is not life. It's just a thing that's happened. Yeah. You just break your leg and you can't do what you wanted to do next Saturday. You can't play football or whatever. It's very sad, but it's just a moment in time. It'll pass, and you're okay about it, because you think, okay, I'm a bit sad about that, and I'm okay. So one of the secrets of that is knowing yourself. And this is a great topic, because, as I often say, you didn't choose to be you. I didn't choose to be me. So when it started off, when I was conceived, I have two parents, and you know, their genes, a selection of each of their genes got together. So I got that genotype. Mm. And then there I am developing in the womb, depending on what sort of time my mum is having when she's pregnant. I'm experiencing that. I'm sharing that, both chemically by being fed by her bloodstream, but also energetically, because I'm inside her, and if she's stressed, if there's loud noise going on, I'm getting that in there. So even by the time I'm born, I'm already unique and different, not just genetically, but also from the experiences I've had in the womb and my birth experience, which is potentially quite a traumatic experience. Then I have my first few years of life, during which I'm mostly influenced by parents, but potentially also by older siblings, teachers, grandparents. And then by the age of 6 or 7, you know, I'm pretty much me. And I didn't choose that. Mm. But how I then respond to the world depends on the model that I've got in here. And everybody's got a different model. So we tend to judge other people and ourselves for behaving in certain ways, and mostly they can't help it. So Donald Trump, gotta choose Donald. Donald Trump didn't choose to be Donald Trump. He can't help being Donald Trump. So I can judge his behavior, but I can't judge him, because if I'd been sort of born in his body and lived his life, I'd be him. And I would do what he does, because he can't do anything else, because that's who he, that's the model he's got in here. Now, once you are on the journey that you're on, so you start self-reflection, you start to become aware of, oh yeah, I always get angry in that situation. I don't want to get angry in that situation. I can learn how not to get angry in that situation. I don't become someone else, but I at least have some choice over my behavior. Now, I'm assuming Donald Trump is not what we might call a conscious being. He hasn't done a lot of self-reflection, I don't think. So therefore, he doesn't have that choice. So all his thoughts and behaviors are automatic. Just he's told what to do by his brain. It's just like most of our thoughts. If I sit here and wait for a thought to come, I won't choose it. It'll just come, you know, but it'll come based on the model that I've got in here and the previous experiences that I've had. So it won't be random. The thoughts that I get will be different from the thoughts that you'll get. And most of them, even if I happen to be a member of Mensa, a genius, most of them will still be rubbish. Yeah. And that's okay. It's normal.
Yeah.
And but the moment you start noticing your own thoughts, and for me, meditation, mindfulness, that's the biggest part of it, is being aware of what's coming out of my mind and therefore having a choice over how I respond. That's the biggest thing, knowing yourself and therefore not judging yourself. Whether because I don't have to think I'm the greatest person on earth, and I don't think I'm a piece of shit. I'm just me.
Yeah.
And I'm okay, and you're okay. And so the fact that nobody chooses to be them, and most of the time, most people out there have not ever done any self-reflection. So as they wander around the town and the shops and you see them, they're literally, in fact, I'm not a Christian, but it says in the Bible, forgive them for they know not what they do. And I'm sure that's what that means. Most people don't know what they're doing. Literally, they don't know what they're doing. They just do it because that's what they're programmed to do. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Because you, when you're a child, you look at all these adults, you think they've got it all figured out. They've figured out this planet. And then as you get older and older, you think no one really knows what's going on. We're all just trying to figure it all out. And by the time we start, I think Joe Rogan says this quite a lot. Just by the time you're starting to get there, you die because you're just starting to figure out what's going on. And there's an interesting thing that Greg from Sacred Tree said. He was on the podcast a little while ago. He said he was talking about the difference between shame and guilt, and he was saying guilt is I think I've done something wrong, and shame is I am wrong, or I think I'm wrong. I thought, I've never heard that distinguishment before. That was quite interesting.
And for that reason, I think shame is definitely a lot bigger, a lot deeper, and probably originates at a younger age, because in your first few years of life, the first couple of years of life in particular, you sort of don't separate the world from you. Everything is part of you, really, which, funny enough, was when you become conscious, you sort of go back to the idea that we're all the same thing, but it's different. So if that something goes wrong, it's sort of my fault when I'm little. Even if I've got a terrible dad who's violent and horrible, it's my fault, because everything's my fault. So that's where shame often comes from, that if I've done something bad, then it's because I am bad, because everything is down to me. It's a very deep thing. It is possible to let it go, and that's a big part of what I might help people with. And I certainly grew up with shame and guilt, partly through being a Catholic, as Billy Connolly once said, you know, if you're a Catholic, you've got A levels in guilt. And I can remember sitting in the church, and again, I've nothing against people who are devout Roman Catholics. If you're a devout Christian, you live your life in a very moral way. Beautiful. I just don't happen to believe in the fundamental dogma. But I was sat in church as a young man on a lovely sunny day, and the priest would be telling me how sinful I was. And I thought, crikey, most of my friends aren't even here. How come I'm sinful? What about them? Yeah, I thought this was a bit unfair. And I carried that for years, that how unfair life was, that I was always being told how sinful I was. And I thought, actually, on the whole, I wasn't bad, you know? I was a very good little child.
Yeah, yeah. It's good that you could recognise that, because I guess a lot of people don't, and they carry that around. But I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on crying. And the reason I ask that is I've been thinking about this a lot recently. It's something we suppress. It's something so natural. You see some, I don't know, look at, like I say, a funeral in Africa. People are wailing and they're really getting stuff out. And I've noticed here we suppress all that. And so I'm wondering, has that, A, by not doing it, that's a problem because we're not expressing something. And B, I'd also love to know your thoughts on by also not letting that out, is that then causing damage to us later on? So any thoughts on crying, really?
I would extend it to all emotion, really. And emotion has an energy to it. And it's telling us something. And blocking any emotion is not good. So, emotions, it's the best way is to really is feel your emotion. Now then, we do tend to suppress our children's emotions. I had mine suppressed, and I definitely suppressed my children's. I feel embarrassed to say, because the thing will tend to happen, say if one of the older kids is bullying one of the younger kids and he's crying, and he's crying, and of course big boys don't cry. So I'll say to him, now stop your crying, because his crying is making me feel uncomfortable. Stop that crying and we'll sort it out. Whereas now I'm thinking that I've learned a bit more about emotion, I would say, hey, come here. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's okay. Have a little cry. And now let's sort it out. You know, so just we don't have to go on and on crying, but we do at least have to acknowledge you feel upset. Therefore, let's be with that for a little moment. Now, as an adult, if I get angry, which is probably my dominant negative emotion, like it is with many men, I need to feel that emotion. But I don't have to act it out, but I need to just feel the energy of it. And actually, the best thing is to separate it from the story, because usually most adult emotion is triggered emotion. I'm going around a bit the wrong way around here, but I'll come to crying, in that the situation that's making me angry is simply reminding part of my brain in the limbic system of a situation that it had when you were a child that was upsetting. And so we have the same reaction to it. So we're not specifically upset by this situation so much as we're upset by the fact that we're reminded of a previous thing. So crying and all emotions have their place. Now then, my emotion was so suppressed, nobody's fault. It's just it was the time that we lived in as a child. And I remember crying a lot as a child, but eventually I must have stopped. Because I joke about it, but I don't think I even knew I had an emotion until I was about 40. people would say to you, you know, are you upset? And I probably still do this sometimes. I say, no, I'm not upset. How many times do I have to tell you I'm not upset? I'm not angry. We've seen that before, I bet. Whereas actually for the best thing for me now is this, first of all, be mindful. Notice, oh, hang on a minute. I noticed some anger here. You've got to notice it. That's a key thing, and we'll come back to that in a minute. For me, then, the best thing to do is take myself out of the situation if possible. And then just shut the story up that, you know, that person shouldn't have done that, that person shouldn't have said that, or whatever. And just feel the physicality of the emotion. I don't have to use words, I don't have to analyze it, I don't wonder where it comes from. Just let it sort of flow through me for a minute or two, that's all. Just listening to the message almost, just feel the feeling. And then I can breathe it out. And I'm sort of back in the room now from a hypnotic point of view. Right. Do I need to do anything about this thing that just happened? Now I'm in my full senses, 99 times out of 100. No, it's nothing. It's a trivial little thing. The person said something. So what? And if it's tears, so grief is a fine example. I lost someone a couple of years ago, and very painful. So when I went into the clinic in the morning, when I always go in early, no one else there. I would just sit at my desk and just cry for maybe quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and then it'd be done. And I did that for a couple of weeks, and it was done. Grief was done. Now, my kids, who'd lost their mum, and we were separated, but the kids had lost their mum, much bigger grief for them. But ultimately, in the same way, you just have to feel it. Yeah, it's painful. You don't want to feel it. But There's something beautiful in actually letting yourself feel it. And it's the quickest way to get through it. You can't go around it. You've got to go through it. And if you don't go through it at the time, yes, the point that you made, either physically or psychologically, it's going to have some rebound on you if you don't express that emotion.
Yeah, yeah. People say, for example, you need to stay strong for this person. Don't, because if you start crying, they're going to start crying. You know, somebody's sick. And part of me's like, okay, I get that, but that really goes against something inside. Yeah. Going, no, we shouldn't be. Surely this is the time to express our truest emotions. Because if the worst happens and you didn't express that, who have you helped really? Other than you've just stopped us feeling a little bit uncomfortable. So I have a real problem with that.
And there's an interesting man called Tim Freak. Freke, and I'm not sure if he invented the term, but he uses the term paralogical thinking. And it's I think of it as a sort of Eastern type of thinking as opposed to a Western type of thinking. You know, it's just if what I'm calling the Western type is, are you that or are you that? Or being the big word, whereas the Eastern type is I'm that and I'm that. So for instance, I can be weeping in grief and strong for my family at the same time. Weeping does not stop me being strong. So, you know, are you angry or are you okay? Well, actually, I feel angry and I'm okay because in this moment, it's okay to feel angry.
Yes.
Because, you know, the government's doing this, or there's poverty, or there's whatever there happens to be. Anger is not, in this case, a triggered response. It's an appropriate response. And yeah, I do feel angry and I'm okay. It's not, am I angry or am I okay? Does that make sense? So I think it is good to be strong. If you're the father of the family, fine, be strong.
Yeah.
And cry.
It's even like last week we were watching, I can't remember what we were watching now, just a silly film, and it was a bit emotional. And my girlfriend goes, are you crying? I was like, no, I'm not crying. And like, it's even just this reaction to, I can't show any emotion, but then I catch myself and go, but it's okay to cry. There's no problem with that. But it's such a strong thing in our society where you don't cry and it's weakness. Yeah. And even though I know that's crazy, I've got 40 years of conditioning going, don't cry, because that's bad.
You're right. And so particularly if you're male, of course, you know, much more permission for women to cry. And it's not good. So I'm all for masculinity being strong, not saying that femininity isn't, it's a different kind of strong. So I'm totally up for that. And emotional at the same time, whatever's appropriate. Emotions, very important, as long as you don't stay in them. But if you allow them, it's like any energy. If you allow it, it flows. And if you block it, it stops. And if it's blocked, just common sense tells you there's going to be a kind of problem. You know, if you block the drain, there's some kind of backup in there. And then you're going to get some trouble. Yeah,
I heard you probably know more about the numbers, but I heard something like going switching to laughter now. I think a toddler laughs 300 times a day or something around that figure, but the adult laughs around 15 times a day. And that was a shocking stat. I don't know if they're the exact numbers, but I think you know percentages are about right. So I've started watching just Modern Family on Netflix, and I will laugh out loud probably 10 or 15 times just in each 20 minute episode. What can you talk a bit about what's going on with the brain and how we feel when we laugh?
Do you know what? I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I know that you're absolutely right. The kids laugh more, and I know that it's very, very good for you. And I imagine that it's a totally relaxing state. It's probably an alpha state, maybe a little bit into a beta state, but it's certainly not a stress state. There will be some kind of good neurotransmitters, maybe serotonin, maybe GABA, so it's relaxing. Those are off the top of my head. It's be interesting to find out. I'm sure, as we said, knowledge is democratic.
Yes,
find it out in a moment. But we were watching comedy last night, which is Friday night last night, and everybody down there. And that's the other thing. If watch comedy, do watch it with other people. It's much more fun that
much
way.
Much more fun, yeah. You know, going to, obviously we're in a pandemic right now, which we don't need to talk too much about, but one of my favourite things to do is go and watch live comedy when you're surrounded by people and you've got this kind of mass hypnosis going on where you're all laughing at the same time, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah, have you ever fancied doing it?
I have, actually. I don't know how funny I'd be, but I've not done it. No, have you had a go at doing it?
I sort of did it. I did it one year at a business network thing that I belonged to. We had a Christmas thing. And one year, I can remember there were three of us. Again, we'd had a couple of drinks at this particular Christmas thing. And there was a comedy act. And the three of us thought to ourselves, well, that was a bit rubbish. And we said to the main man, we said, next year, we'll do it.
Okay.
And of course, as that came around, oh, we're doing it. So we did various different things. And I did a 20 minute, maybe more, I don't know, sort of stand-up comedy routine.
Yeah.
But I'm prepared for it. I just looked at every joke site I could find, every joke book I could find, and just looking for jokes I'd never heard before.
Mm.
And I found loads, and you know, maybe some of the people had heard before, but they were ones that were not often heard. And I loved it, actually. Mm. I really loved it. So very different from being a performer and being able to just ad lib and doing all that kind of stuff. I had a rehearsed routine.
Yeah,
and but it was a blast, I've got to say.
No, very cool. I in my previous career, I would do a lot of big presentations to, you know, between sort of 100 to 400 people.
Yeah,
and as I got more and more confident, I would start to drop in. Now, let's be honest, I'm at work in a corporate environment, so it's never going to be Lee Evans or, you know, any of those guys. But there would be times where I'd be like, I would say something and get the laugh. And part of me would be like, oh, I quite enjoy that. I quite enjoy that feedback of making a big group of people laugh. But what was interesting was I would sometimes have to do the presentation like in, say, at 1 p.m. and then for another group at 2 p.m. and you wouldn't get the laugh at the same point. I'd be like, oh, I'm not prepared for this because I just made the joke that got a real good chuckle an hour ago at the exact same point, and now none of you guys are laughing, and I don't know how to handle that. And obviously that I know it's completely different from comedy, but still.
But I guess, you know, the pros practice for that.
That's it.
They practice for not getting the laugh, and they'll have a line for that.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So it's fascinating. A bit of comedy chess. Can I ask you, Rory, some breathing stuff then? So, do you know much about the vagus nerve and what's going on there when you're doing slow exhalations and what the vagus nerve is?
Yeah. So the vagus nerve is, I think it's the longest nerve in the body. It's the 10th cranial nerve. So the cranial nerves come from your brain. They don't go down the normal route. The vagus nerve is called vagus because I think it's Latin for wandering, because it goes all around the place. It innervates part of your facial muscles and heart and lungs, and then goes down through the diaphragm and innervates all your internal organs. So there are various different parts of your vagus nerve, and there's an element that's going down and there's an element that's coming back up. So your, for instance, stimulation of part of the vagus nerve will slow your heartbeat down. But also there's information coming back up from the heart and from the guts and telling you information about what's going on in the body. Mm. So I think with rhythmic breathing, you will stimulate that part of the vagus nerve that is relaxing. It's what's known as part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm. It's relaxing. And even if you can do that with just rhythmic breathing, sort of 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out, what they call coherent breathing. And you can augment it sometimes by making the breath out slightly longer. Because if you just look at me, when I breathe in, it looks as if I'm sort of tensing. It's obvious which one is relaxing, isn't it? So you don't have to make the breath out longer, but if you do, then you'll stimulate the vagus nerve a little more. There's in recent years, there's been the discovery by Stephen Porges of another part of the vagus nerve which innervates the facial muscles and the ear and the voice, I think. And the reason why a child will feel comforted by a parent is because the parent is maybe having a slightly sing-song voice and lovely smiling facial expression. Yeah. And all these things, a child is programmed to respond to the calming things, even if the parent, because the child often doesn't have any words when they're very young. So even if the parent is just, you know, talking gibberish, talking blah, 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 if they're making the right gestures and the right sort of tone, then that will be relaxing. So the kind of breath work that you're doing for that is slow rhythmic breathing, and particularly that with an emphasis on the out breath. I know that, what's the guy's name? Is it Richard Brown? Dr. Richard Brown, I think. Whereas there is the box breathing 4444, Richard Brown, I saw one the other day, which is really quite nice, was 4462. So four in, four hold, six out, and then two hold out. So just making the breath out slightly longer.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we can play with these. I'm not sure. For the coherent breathing, there's certainly some physiological research behind that. But some of these other types of breathing have just been done for millennia, and people find them to be to have an effect.
Yeah.
So I'm a pragmatist. I do, because of my background, I like finding research that backs this stuff up. But also, I like, if I do something and I feel good, I'm sort of happy with that.
Yeah, yeah, I like that too. I've really enjoyed recently just doing the humming breath. And I can go for on and on and on with that. It's fascinating how much you can slow your breath down. Do you know any more about the humming and what that's doing? Because I know it's releasing nitric oxide, but I don't know if you know any more.
Yeah, but it's also stimulating the vagus nerve.
Right.
And I think it's that part of that social vagus system again. I may be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure in addition to nitric oxide and breathing through the nose, I forgot to mention that their humming does add to that general effect of the rhythmic breathing and the prolonged breath out humming. Great. Yeah.
It's a great practice. It just feels so, just because you feel a bit silly doing it as well. You're doing it.
Yeah.
And again, it comes back to what we say. No, you're playing a little bit because, you know, adults don't hum, do they? That's a silly thing to do. But so there's something there.
I remember having a great experience once in a sort of in a ceremony where we're doing this thing called chakra toning. So each of the chakras has a different frequency, a sound frequency that applies to it. So you start off with the root chakra, and the person who's leading it would just chant that tone. And then gradually everyone in the room would sort of join in with that tone. So everybody's chanting the same tone, as long as they got some kind of sense of music, but different voices, of course, and because you've got different sort of breath capacities, sort of all starting and finishing at different times. And if you've got the right room and the right number of people, that's mind-blowing kind of to be part of, because you're contributing to it, but you're also receiving it. Not just humming, but sort of almost group humming. Lovely.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, because you're getting the vibrations back, aren't you? It's not just you doing it, it's coming. Oh, that sounds fascinating. Be good to get your thoughts on the diaphragm, and in particular, is there any sort of neurofeedback you're getting from that? And I'm also interested to know your thoughts on the, kind of the massaging of the organs with it and that sort of thing. So anything really on the diaphragm would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, diaphragm, compared to probably every other muscle in the body, is one of the most difficult muscles to access and to deliberately control. You can learn to control it by doing just breathwork practices and using sort of abdominal breathing, opening up, just sort of feedback stuff. Is if you sort of see that your lower chest is able to expand when you breathe in, then you know that actually you're using your diaphragm. So of course you can't see your diaphragm directly, but when your diaphragm comes down, yes, your abdomen will come out a bit, but also your lower chest will expand. And if you want to measure how you're doing over a period of time, yeah, measure that with a tape measure, and you'll see that the distance on the tape measure from full breath out to full breath in at the lower part of your ribs will increase with time as you get better at it. And yes, because it's a very powerful muscle. It's a big muscle, goes right across your body. And if you've used it plenty, it's a very strong muscle. And every time it comes down, because obviously I've had the good fortune of being able to look inside the abdominal cavity, both in a dead body and in a live body. And there is no room in there. Everything is packed in. There's no space. You know, everything's next to each other. So inevitably, you've got an enclosed space in there. So if the diaphragm and the pelvic floor, diaphragm at the top, pelvic floor at the bottom, when these things move up and down, they have to massage the organs because there's nowhere for the organs to go. Yeah. You know? So, which is why quite often, in addition to doing abdominal, lower chest, diaphragmatic breathing, a lot of breath practices will also use the pelvic floor, sort of bringing that up to increase that effect of massaging the organs. Now, again, in terms of research, I don't know of any. I'm not saying there isn't. I don't know of any research that's described the physiology of having your organs massaged by your diaphragm. It's a practice from yoga hundreds of years old, and people have clearly found it beneficial. And it makes intuitive sense that it would be beneficial. I'll make a personal note to myself to go and look, because I hope there is some research. And if there isn't, it would be nice that there was some. So I suspect if you're someone, if you're someone who suffers from an irritable bowel, clearly learning how to do relaxed breath work is going to help you anyway, because it's going to stimulate your vagus nerve. But it would be nice to somehow have some physiological measurement of what's happening and in the bowel, and I don't know the answer to that.
Heard people talk about IBS and diabetic, I think also there's something going on with the heart as well. If you're doing proper diaphragmatic breathing, you're almost massaging the heart a little bit, because there's not a lot of space.
There's no space in there either.
Yeah,
It wouldn't make sense for there to be space.
Yeah,
it's a waste of space. You're not going to have like a big air pocket in there. That's troublesome. So yeah. Everything in the body, in every compartment is sort of tucked together.
Yeah. I've got this. I haven't really played with it too much. I don't know if you've come across any of these devices. This one's the O2 Trainer by Baz Rutan. And essentially, I think the theory is that you can do it with balloons as well. What people will do is you can put different resistance bands on it, and then you just you exhale out. And I think the theory is it's making the diaphragm stronger and creating a bit more of a stronger core. Have you had any experience with any of that?
I've got no experience of those, but I'm certainly interested. And I know I've seen, I don't think it was that one, but I've seen Ben Greenfield has another one. That I don't know, there was one you had on here, you had Anders Ericsson on here. Is that his?
No,
because he has a device.
He has, I think, one. So there's the field. Yeah, this is Baz Rutan. This is the ex-UFC world champions version of it.
Yeah. So I think potentially it would be possible. You can have gadgets that will train expiratory muscles. There'll be gadgets that will train inspiratory muscles. You can wear masks to anything that makes it a bit harder to do. And simply, we know that actually breathing through your nose makes it slightly harder to breathe than breathing through your mouth. And that's a good thing. That's part of one of the many kind of good things about breathing through the nose. But yeah, any of these muscles that you're using, particularly the diaphragm, to breathe, if you can find a way of making that stronger. So I think, again, I don't know specifically the research on the particular tool that you have there or any of the tools, but it's logical and it makes perfect sense that if you make breathing in harder to do, make breathing out harder to do, you have to use your muscle more, the muscle's going to get stronger without a doubt. You just makes need sense. To prove it.
And it's a bit like, you know, so two revelations I've had over the last couple of years. One was, use the nose, like we've just spoke about, because I think most people still don't realize that. You go, I know there's no gyms open right now, but if you go into an average gym a year ago, most people are panting through the mouth and don't even realize that they should be using. And then the other thing was, I did a podcast with Belissa Varanich, and she's big into functional breathing, and she was talking about gut sucking, and I was like, oh, I'm a gut sucker, you know, because I don't want to show my gut to anybody, so I would just walk around with it sucked in because I think that would look better. But I didn't realize the years of damage that I've been doing there, not using that diaphragm properly.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I think, and I only got into, I think it was the year before last, but I learned to run breathing through my nose. And after all these years, it was a painful experience because, of course, when you start off, you have to slow down considerably just to be able to do it, especially going uphill. In fact, I had to walk up some of the hills to be able to carry on nose breathing at the start because I've been such a mouth breather through my life. But now I'll do all my runs breathing through my nose, and I do, without doubt, get the benefits. So that was, there was a, I can't remember the name of the book, but it was John Dewyard wrote that book years ago. He's still about, still a holistic doctor in the States, but he wrote a book about predominantly about nasal breathing during exercise. So very occasionally, if I'm doing a real sprint finish, I might do some mouth breathing at the end. But for me, even then, I'm quite often doing nose breathing. So any kind of exercise, the more you can breathe through your nose, without a doubt.
Better. So you've done, I know you've done a number of different breath work courses and you've spent a lot of time looking at the breath. What kind of are your main key takeaways on kind of functional or holistic breathing?
I think for me, because so often in my practice, it's something about having control of your autonomic nervous system. This is a key thing. So we have parts of my nervous system that are under my conscious control. So I can move my hand around here because it's that part of my nervous system. But if I wanted to just make my pancreas produce a little bit more lipase enzyme right now, just squirt a little bit extra, I can't do that. But there is. The vagus nerve does that. So there is a nerve that goes from my brain to there. So it's possible for it to be done. So I can sort of learn how to get control. And how do I do that? Well, somehow I have to find something that crosses over from one part of the nervous system to the other. And it's not the only one, but it's certainly the main one, is breathing. And what I mean by that is breathing is part done by the autonomic nervous system. You know, just like my pancreatic lipase, when I'm asleep, when I'm working, when I'm talking to you, it's still doing its stuff. I carry on breathing. I carry on producing pancreatic lipase. But unlike the lipase, if I want to, I could take control of the breath, and I can either hold my breath or I can make it go fast. So I've got dual control. Now, the importance of that is by learning to control my breathing more, I can start to control my autonomic nervous system. Because if I do those things like slow, nasal, rhythmic, diaphragmatic breathing, I know that it will stimulate my vagus nerve, which is part of the autonomic nervous system. And all those things that are innervated by that, all my internal organs will work better. My circulation will open up. Everything will work better because I now have an ability to calm it. I also have the ability, of course, to arouse it if I want to, if the situation demands. You know, if I've got to, you know, do a deadlift or something and I want to get into that, fine. I need my nervous system to be really firing. I don't want to be in a kind of really, you know, chilled. That's not the best way to lift a heavy weight, I need to be fired up. So a little bit of, and one of the Wim Hof things that you'll have done, of course, is to do 30 breaths and then, you know, do your press-ups while you're still holding your breath. The first time I did that, I was just gobsmacked. Astonishing. Just the energy rushing through you and the ability to do that. So that's what it's about. I don't want to be calm all the time. There are times when I need to be aroused. If someone attacks, you know, my family, or if I'm going for a run, if I'm playing rugby, there are times when I need to be up and there are times when I need to be down. And so the more I have control over that, the more I have access to all parts of my system. You know, we live in a world now where if you have enough money and you live in the Western world, you could live pretty much your entire life at a uniform temperature because you have heaters and air conditioners in your car and your office and your home. And you can live everything at the same pace. Nothing ever changes. Your body's never stressed. You never go without food. You never have to kind of run very fast. Clearly, that would be very comfortable and desirable for some people.
Yes.
But actually, your body is going to fail. So our bodies need to be challenged. So the ability, and this takes us into the heat and the cold and exercise and meditation, having access to both ends and stretching the ends. We can go to colder and we can go to warmer. There's a wide range that we feel, actually, I'm okay in that heat, I'm okay in that cold, I function. And that, as an animal, that makes us a much more functional person. So in terms of breath work, I do every morning, I will do some fast stuff, two rounds of that and some breath holds. I will every day do some days I do coherent breathing, you know, the 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out one. Some days I do box breathing. I always listen to a recording to do this just because I like having a recording. If I do the coherent breathing, I quite often go, there's on YouTube, there's a clock and it is 6 seconds out. It's just a clock, a bit like a Tabata clock. And so there's no voice there. And I just quite like it because it stops after 20 minutes. So I know I'm doing 20 minutes of that. And if I'm doing box breathing, I like to listen to Mark Divine on Neurohacker. He did a thing for them. And it's a long chat, but so the actual 20-minute exercise is 50 minutes in. But he really makes that box breathing, it's a beautiful example because he takes you through four lots of 5 minutes, doing different things with each 5 minutes. And if anybody's not listened to that, I would recommend that they do. And I just think he's a great guy for advocating box breathing. So I will I use breath work of some sort with virtually every person. It's one of the foundations that you come in. So whatever your problem is, It's a bit like if I don't know anything about plants really. I know to water them, but if I had a plant that wasn't looking very well, I don't have to know anything about plant diseases to know that probably if I get a new pot and some new soil and water it and find out what light it likes, basically give it the right environment, there's a pretty good chance that it will recover.
Yeah.
So in a way, I often don't need a diagnosis. I just need to know that if I give you the right water, the right fuel, the right movement, the right rest, and detox, probably you'll function better, you know, without having any idea what was wrong with you in the first place. You know? So there's an element where you could do the same for everybody. Clearly you do some different things for different people, but if you just did the same for everybody, people would do massively well.
Yeah, there's this piece that has become more and more evident the more I see it, which is, I don't know what people call it, ancestral health or functional health. But it's things such as, and I think we've touched on some of these today, it's, you know, we sit at a desk all day, we should be standing. We don't touch the ground with our bare feet, so we're keeping a load of energy that probably needs to go. We don't get enough daylight on our body. We're staring at a screen too much. We're distracted. So all these things, and often, it's not, I don't think it's always the case, but you can almost always go, well, if you remove those things or go back to the way that we probably evolved, the food that we eat. I've only just recently started to discover the power of chewing. That's just blown my mind, and how we're not chewing properly, we're eating baby food. But every time it's almost like we've kind of de-evolved a little bit over the last couple of hundred years, and we're doing all things wrong, and now people are starting to look backwards again, aren't they, the way we used to be?
Without a doubt, we don't move enough. So making movement sort of easy, in that I live about, and I now live 6 miles from the office. And when we lived 3 miles from the office, I just walk most days. 6 miles just takes me probably an hour and a half. It's quite a long time. So quite often I cycle now. And so that when I cycle, it's just then part of my day. I don't have to think about doing some exercise, because it's just part of my day. But I also set it up in the office, and it's easy for me. I'm self-employed. I have my own office. Not everybody's got that, but I set it up to make movement easy. So between patients, you know, there's a pull-up bar there, there's a deadlift bar there, there's some kettlebells there. So not only the equipment that you can use, but they're there in my line of sight.
Yeah.
And there's some steps to go up. The staircase to go up if I want to make myself a coffee.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll do two fitted jumps up two steps at a time. Or I'll carry a kettlebell in each hand up the steps. So without actually going to the gym, because I never go to the gym. I either like to exercise outside, climb a tree or something, or I just use my office sort of surroundings to do it. And then it's again, it's more, I suppose, it's more like what an ancestral person did, because they were sort of moving throughout the day rather than going to the gym 3 times a week and then sitting for the rest of the time. So the environment thing is important. If you make it easy to exercise, you're much more likely to exercise. If you've got to kind of get in your car, go to the gym, very often you'll think,
not today.
No,
that's true. I have got not that quite sweet setup you've just described, but there are a few bits around my office.
Great.
Some weights, and I've got my yoga mat, and I'll try and do that. But we're waiting to move house, but when we do, I'm looking forward to getting a pull-up bar, because I love hanging. I just love that experience of not using these shoulders properly and just being able to hang and let everything kind of just stretch out. Just feels wonderful.
A lot of people, in fact, talking about that, people who come in with all sorts of shoulder problems, particularly what they call rotator cuff problems. Sometimes if all they did for the next 6 months was hang every day, often solves that problem. It solved my shoulder problems, hanging.
I suppose if you look at what we've evolved from, you know, apes and monkeys, they're all, you know, hanging. And we and it's the thing, isn't it? I realise that we very rarely, because you talk about comfort and how we've set up this lovely climate environment and we've got light all night and all these different things. It's very rare that we have to lift things above our head these days, unless it's like the suitcase at the airport, you know, going into the plane. Yeah. And so we've lost this kind of function of like lifting above our heads. And so we've become, I feel so weak and stuck here.
And it's a good, it's funny, it's a good feedback with pull-ups in that game, because I look like this. I try not to look in the mirror very often, funny enough. So over Christmas, I put a few pounds on and I wouldn't really have noticed that. I just noticed the pull-ups were getting difficult. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hang on a minute. Oh, I know what that is. So it's just a little signal. If I want to do as many pull-ups as I want to do, as I did before, much easier doing pull-ups if you take a few pounds off.
Yes, yeah, that's so true, isn't it? Yeah, I've experienced the same problems. It's funny, my clothes must have shrunk over Christmas. I don't know what happened there. So yeah, coincidence. So my last question for you, Rory, is a big one, I guess, but it's, so if someone's listened to this podcast now, we've been going for a good hour and a bit here, hour and a half, I think. If they've listened to this now and they're thinking there's some great stuff here, how does it stop just being a conversation they listen to and then they forget about? What action could you advise that somebody takes over the next sort of 24 hours to put them on a bit of a journey now on some of the stuff we've talked about? Is it a book? Is it a practice? Is it going to look at something on the website?
I think it is practices. Practices are the key to change. Change your mind, have a meditation practice to change your body, have an exercise practice and a food practice, change your environment. As we said, apart from making exercise easy, make healthy eating easy. Just so maybe one of the big things they could do is go through the cupboards, and nobody doesn't know what is junk. And so in the clinic, at home here, there is a bit of junk around. I do sometimes see a bit of junk. But in the clinic, where I spend a lot of my time, my day times, and I have two of my meals there, there's never any junk. Mm-hmm. So even if I was feeling like it, it's just never there. Mm-hmm. So the only thing I can eat when I'm at work is what I brought, which is something that's nutritious and good. So make the environment good. But now, if there was one thing to do, perhaps the first thing is to get a piece of paper out and find the reason why you want to make a change, and also sort of have an idea 3 months' time, 6 months' time, if things could be different, how would I like to be in terms of my body, in terms of my mind, in terms of my relationships, in terms of my stress? What would I like to be different? Because at least if I have an idea, like any journey, if I have an idea of my destination, there's much more likely that I'm going to find a way to get there. So maybe that would be the thing, to not so much what am I not happy about, although that's sometimes a way of, if you write all the things that you hate about yourself and your life now, it'll sometimes say, well, the opposite of that then is, so if I really don't like the fact that I'm a stone overweight, well, over there, what do I want? I want to be 11 stone or whatever it happens to be. And so I'm going to cheat and say two things. I would say have a destination that you want. How would you like to be, you know, realistically, but, you know, if you made some effort. And how would that feel? Why do I want that? How would it make me feel? Because getting an emotion, you know, this is Joe Dispenza's big thing. You have a clear intention. Joe Dispenza always calls it clear intention and an elevated emotion. Put those things together. One or other by itself maybe won't get you there. But if you've got both, you've got a real clear destination and you've got a reason to get there, very good chance you'll get there.
I love that. And then also clear some rubbish out your cupboards if you get the opportunity as well. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, cool. Fantastic. Thank you. If people want to know more about yourself, is there a place they can go online to check you out?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, but actually, because my name is unusual, Rory McGill, If you Google Dr. Rory McGill, you'll find me anyway. But actually, my website is called Plymouth Holistic Doctor. .co.uk. That's probably the best place. Yeah.
Wonderful. So I'll put the link in the description below. So guys, cool. After this, you can just click on that and
I'm very happy to, people live far away. I can certainly do plenty online consultations. Very happy to do that. But I'm also happy if people email me, put my email down there as well, just to, if people want to ask questions. I'm fortunate. I'm absolutely blessed in doing a job that I love doing. I never stop being interested in it. So, people that I know, they often say to me, oh, I shouldn't ask you this because you're off duty. I think, oh, come on, ask me. ask me. I love it.
Yeah.
So, people can ask questions. I'm happy to answer.
Fantastic. No, that's very generous of you. Thank you. And it comes across that you love what you do as well. You can always tell when somebody loves what they do. And Rory, it definitely comes across for you. So thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed that. And obviously, we've spoke many times, but I've really, really enjoyed having that focused conversation. So that was lovely. And maybe we can do a part two at some point, because I feel like we've only scratched the surface today and there's loads more to come.
Yeah. And separately, Mike, it is really good to talk to you, and I haven't seen you for a while. And it would be good to catch up as well. You don't have to keep that in, but it would be good to catch up. Yeah.
No, that definitely. So I'll sign off now, and we can stay on and have a bit of a chat actually.
Yeah.
But guys, thank you so much for watching the podcast. Leave comments below, click on the links, and we'll see you on the next Breathcast. Cheers. And Rory, once again, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mike.
Cheers.